Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a new and alarming report from the United Nations, which is the most comprehensive and thorough check on the health of our planet ever undertaken by the world's leading scientists, that finds 1 million species are at risk of extinction as the ecosystems on which we and other species depend are deteriorating more rapidly than ever. Dr. David Abura, the coordinator of Cordio East Africa, whose conservation activities in mainland Africa and Indian Ocean Islands states include research, monitoring, and capacity building of coral reefs and coastal ecosystems, joins us. A global authority on threats to coral reefs, David is a lead author of the UN's just-released Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services. With coral reefs acting as a critical indicator of impending changes to other natural and human-dominated ecosystems so that we can prepare for and mitigate future disasters, we'll discuss the gulf between what the science is telling us and what politicians are prepared to do. But with nature being destroyed at a rate tens to hundreds of times higher than the average over the past 10 million years, the report finds we are eroding the very foundations of economies, livelihoods, food security, health, and the quality of life worldwide. Then we will put the new UN report in the broader context of the growing threat global warming poses to the planet itself and speak with David Wallace Wells, the deputy editor at New York Magazine and the author of the new book, The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming. He joins us for a stark assessment of global warming's effects on human, plant, and animal life over the coming decades. We'll discuss how significant an impact the acceleration of global warming has been in the relatively short window of the past 30 years since Bill McKibben and Al Gore first alerted the public about the threat to life on this planet that will ensue if global warming is not understood and dealt with. He describes a scenario and presents a grim vision of what life could be like in the not-too-distant future on our endangered Earth if immediate actions are not taken. And while the United States is the only country on Earth where global warming denial is holding up progress, our growing awareness of the need to address the issue still does not begin to catch up with the scope of the looming catastrophe global warming presents. And joining us now from East Africa is Dr. David Abura, who is the coordinator for Cordio East Africa, supporting conservation activities in mainland Africa and in the Indian Ocean island states, including research, monitoring, and capacity building of coral reefs and coastal ecosystems. A global authority on the threat to coral reefs, he is a lead author on the UN's Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystems. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. David Abura.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, thank you. And the UN report that just came out has really shaken people up. And it points out that the very foundation of economies, livelihoods, food security, health, and the quality of life worldwide is threatened by the loss of biodiversities, with 1 million species threatened. So let's talk a little bit about, just to begin, about the panel itself. A number of scientists around the world, they've compiled 1,500 academic studies. Your specialty is coral reefs, but I take it coral reefs in many ways are like the canary in the coal mine when it comes to the effects of global warming.
Yes, that's right. So I work on coral reefs, and really they're a signature ecosystem. So not just the effects of climate change, because they are so sensitive to increasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, but also for increasing population and consumption on a planetary scale and how much we're extracting from nature. So as one of my roles on the panel, and we were, yes, over 150 scientists from around the world, was to really bring in the perspective from coral reefs and from Africa in terms of understanding the dependence of people on nature and then what it means to us when that nature is declining, because it's not just about losing pretty species or beautiful reefs, but it's really about losing some of the foundations of what we live on and use, living adjacent to coral reefs, but also much further afield as well.
And there are some political activities going on in support of the work, in effect, a lot of people are concerned about global warming, even though here in the United States we're the only country that has denial of global warming literally in our government itself, including our own leader, and much of the Senate and Congress are either in denial or refuse to do anything. So I'm encouraged by some of the activities going on in the school strikes in the UK with the Extinction Rebellion protest. And here in the United States, we do have the Green New Deal debate. But there does seem to be an enormous lag between the science that you and your colleagues are presenting to us and the activities at a political level, not to mention a global level, to deal with this looming crisis.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, there is that huge lag between the science and the knowledge that we have and being able to do something with it in a decision-making context. And I wish it were that, you know, only the U.S. was the only country with that degree of denial about climate change, but it does extend to many others. And it takes many different forms. And I think what's most important is to realize that it's not just a political statement per se. It really comes from a lot of vested interests in the status quo in the current economic system where, you know, maximizing profit from investments and so on is really the touchstone. And I think what the report and what the group has really tried to point out is that there are many different services that come from nature. If you really just prioritize and try to optimize one, such as food production, because you try and, you know, put in so much fertilizer to maximize growth and all sorts and chemicals and hormones, you can really do a huge amount of damage to the balance of nature and to other services, such as climate regulation, that are very valuable to other people as well. So you really need to understand that it's not just about maximizing narrow interests, and those interests are extremely powerful, but working out how to essentially democratize the benefits that come from nature and to share those much more equitably amongst people, and not just in terms of value and or dollar value in terms of trying to measure them.
Well, one of the possibilities in terms of dealing with climate change at a political level is if you've got vested interests like oil companies and the Koch brothers, who spend a lot of money promoting a global warming denial. On the one hand, you also have other big, powerful corporations like insurance companies who have a vested interest in not having to go bankrupt, paying out for the damage caused by climate change. So in your report, you indicate that pollinators, the loss of insects, in particular bees, pollinator loss is about $577 billion in terms of its effects on crop output.
Right.
And then you add to that land degradation, which has reduced the productivity of 23% of land globally. So that would indicate to me that agribusiness would be an ally. Do you see it that way?
Well, that's what you'd think. You'd think that those who really have the most vested in maintaining productivity and the health of the land and the systems that they need, such as pollinators, to pollinate their crops, would act with those interests in mind. But I think part of the problem is the integrated knowledge is very hard to process. And it's the business tends to like quite simple solutions. And so when the science comes up with a lot of ifs and buts, it's quite hard to really focus attention in that direction. But I think it's very interesting that you mentioned the insurance industry. And the message coming from the insurance industry is that they are concerned that climate change is, or they're the first ones, saying that climate change is, you know, not just an environmental problem, but it really is a financial problem because it is something that could break. The current model for insurance doesn't work with climate change if you roll it out 20, 30, 40 years. So I think that sort of realization in the financial sector, I think is good because it means that somebody at the the top of that pyramid realizes that we have to redesign the insurance system so that it is climate proof. What we hope is that that will happen with a much more integrated and coherent sense of all the values of nature and all the different things that need to be taken into account in doing that, not just a narrow finance, profit and loss perspective. And I think that'll be a huge challenge as we go from having written the report now for it to be to go into government and into different industry sectors for the leaders to think about, okay, well, how do we respond to this and how do we do it in a way that's integrated and coherent across multiple sectors within a country and across countries? That'll be a massive challenge. But we need that kind of change to happen. We need to be thinking along those lines.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. David Abura, who is in East Africa. He's a coordinator for Cordio East Africa, supporting conservation activities in mainland Africa and Indian Ocean island states, including research, monitoring, and capacity building of coral reefs and coastal ecosystems, a global authority on threats to coral reefs. He is a lead author on the UN's Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystems. And the report, of course, has just come out, and those who have read it are alarmed at the projections of the loss of wild mammals. The biomass of wild mammals has fallen 82%, and natural ecosystems have lost about half of their area, and a million species are at risk of extinction. And this panel, of course, was compiled over 3 years by more than 450 scientists and diplomats. So again, looking at ways to stop it, because it's just so horrible, and one doesn't want to reinforce despair and a sense of helplessness. For example, much of the rainforests, particularly in Indonesia, are being cut down for palm oil production. Why can't we ban palm oil?
Oh, well, you're taking me way outside of my main expertise level, so it's hard for me to comment on palm oil.
No.
But I think the difficulty is with many of these things is that, our economic system needs certain products, and we need to work out how we supply those, but in a way that is much more sustainable. And doing that across multiple countries with many different societal sectors is a huge challenge. But we certainly need to try definitely get away from monocultural, these vast forestry plantations that focus just on palm oil production, and in the process lose all of the biodiversity and the other services that would be provided by more natural forests or integrated forests and agricultural ecosystems, or just pure primary forest in those locations. So that's the big challenge.
Well, let's focus on your specialty of coral reefs. The coral reef extinction is about one-third of coral reefs are already facing extinction, and that the marine mammals are down by close to one-third. The Great Barrier Reef in Australia, for example, is threatened. It generates an enormous amount of tourist money. So, again, I'm looking around for allies. You've done the work, but I'm looking for allies who are going to carry the ball, if you will, and make the changes necessary before it's too late.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's what we're trying to motivate for as well. And the coral reef example is really good there, because, as you say, in Australia, the Great Barrier Reef, it's one, it's such an iconic system, and two, the industry, the tourism and the recreational fisheries, for example, that supports huge industries. Now, the thing is, what does it cost to sustain a natural asset like that? And we need to work that out by understanding the value of all the different ecosystem services or nature's contributions to people, as we called them in the report. All these nature's gifts that we use, what are they worth to whom, and how do you pay to maintain that? And there should most definitely be, just as we pay bank managers and fund managers to manage our finances, we need to work out what that percentage is that is really necessary to sustain the environments that support our industries and our populations. And with the, we know with climate change that if we can keep it to 1.5 degrees Celsius, which is the best possible outcome for climate change, we're still going to lose up to 90% of coral reefs worldwide. And if we go to 2 degrees, which is the next best option, we're going to lose 99% of coral reefs worldwide. So that's a crisis. It's a real crisis. And we need to somehow motivate people to act, not just to go into despair that, oh, we can't do it, so why bother? We need to work out how we put the money into the right places and we value the right things appropriately to really make that sort of protection a priority, what we all want to do, rather than an afterthought after we've spent money on other things already.
Well, the lungs of the earth, if you will, are Brazil, the rainforests there, yeah. The ones that absorb one of the biggest absorbers of CO2. And we know that the new leadership in Brazil is quite hostile to the environment and wants to cut down more rainforest for beef production. So at the end of the day, does it really mean that we should all become vegetarians? I mean, I know that sounds flip, but frankly, the meat industry is one of the most destructive impacts on our environment, and they also contribute to about 18% of global greenhouse gas emissions, and crop production uses 12% of the land and creates less than 7% of emissions. So it's only feeding the more affluent people in the world in any case, isn't it? So isn't there a correlation between diet and destruction?
Well, I think the thing is, should we all become vegetarians? I think, so the world is more complex than that, that's for sure. You know, people, you know, the media and politicians, campaigns do like the simple message. So my take on the, protein versus vegetarian discussion is we're never going to, you know, Africa is a growing continent. And my focus really is on what sorts of solutions will work in a continent like Africa, where we have 1 billion people, basically, and it's going to grow a lot more in the next few decades, and those people are going to grow in income very rapidly because the baseline is quite low. With new technologies, we're going to leapfrog and, you know, grow much more quickly than others. You cannot tell the growing middle class that it shouldn't eat meat because the people have been aspiring to eat more meat since, you know, for decades of poverty. But what we should be doing is saying we need to decrease the footprint of all the different things that we do as if we were all becoming vegetarians. So you might still eat meat, but less than it would have been 30 years ago. But the energy systems that we use in our cars or in heating or cooling our houses and pumping water and everything that we do have to be that much more fuel efficient. And also all the CO2 is absorbed and scrubbed so that it doesn't go into the atmosphere. And if we do that, if we reduce the technology and the sort of the footprint of all the different things that we do in societies, then, you know, I think we do have a chance. And I think the technologies are there, that the researchers and R&D programs and private sector and the public sector and education who can really work this out. We just need to incentivize it and motivate people to change their behaviors to decrease their footprint in many different ways. It's not only about food. So if we can do that, I think, you know, there's a chance. And one of the main things we've tried to get out in this report is that there is a chance for change if we have transformative change. And that means, you know, big change for everybody. And everybody has to commit to doing that.
Well, already, of course, here the politics in the United States have sort of reached comical proportions. The youngest congressperson, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, is one of the main proponents of the Green New Deal. Already there's a reaction to her on the political right saying she wants to take away our hamburgers. So it's not exactly an elevated discourse going on. But for the first time, the issue of biodiversity loss is now on the G8's agenda, and I believe that next year China is hosting a UN conference to draw up a new global goals for protecting biodiversity. So are you encouraged by that?
That's right. I am encouraged by that. I mean, China is you know, growing into the biggest player out there, and certainly in here in Africa, investment from China is the biggest driver now. It used to be from Europe and the US, but it's no longer that. It's really foreign aid and potential investment from China that's going to drive what we do over the next 10 to 20 years. So, and yet, you know, Chinese markets have a huge impact on our biodiversity in terms of legal and illegal products, and poaching and so on, rhino horn, things like that. So that the China is taking a lead in setting the post-2020 agenda next year, for the next 10 or more years, is great. But as we have done in this report, in the IPBES report, as scientists, we need to defend in the political sphere the intensity and the strength of our conclusions that change is needed and why, because often there's a big push to water things down. So it's certainly a ray of hope. At least it takes the battle to where it should be, I think, in terms of global discourse. But, you know, China, you know, to be honest, you've mentioned the political discourse in the U.S. China has an excuse in a way, and it's come from massive levels of poverty several decades ago and a massive population as well. And yet they are transforming a lot of things internally in the country, in the energy sector and renewables and things like that now. So, I mean, we, the smaller countries, are really looking to the big countries, China, the U.S. and others, to really take the lead on this transformative change and show how it can be done in different ways.
Well, I wouldn't hold my breath on the United States taking the lead, I'm afraid. It's a very sad situation here.
Well,
you know. But at least China, I guess, with a command economy, maybe they can distribute Viagra to all those people who think that having rhinoceros horns are going to make them more potent. I'm not even sure where all of this kind of folklore medicine comes from, but obviously there's a great need to dry up the markets at their source rather than, because trying to stop poachers doesn't seem to work, does it? And that's something that you're dealing with there in Africa.
No, I mean, the market really needs to be stopped. And the demand needs to be stopped for these sorts of things. But the thing is that every culture has its share of, you know, snake oil remedies and things like that, and people peddling those.
Sure.
And, you know, that's the role of science. The thing is, a lot of the science that has gone into this report and climate change science and so on, I mean, a huge amount of it does come from your country, from the U.S. And it's a shame the political system doesn't recognize that now. But things can change quickly. Things can oscillate quickly, and we certainly hope for that. And that we get the longer-term commitments that are coming from cities, from corporations, from states. I think there are some real leadership moves coming in the U.S. and other parts of the world. And so rather than focus on the calamities and just the dark spots, we have to see where these bright spots can really pick up and take the lead and inspire people to change. I mean, a lot of it is behavioral change comes from commitments and inspiration, people wanting to do something. And so we need to emphasize those, because that's where the change will come from.
Well, Dr. David Obura, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay, thank you. It's a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. David Obura, who's the coordinator for Cordio East Africa, supporting conservation activities in mainland Africa and Indian Ocean island states, including research, monitoring, and capacity building of coral reefs and coastal ecosystems, a global authority on the threat to coral reefs. He is a lead author on the UN's Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back putting the new UN report in the broader context of the growing threat global warming poses to the planet itself.
Don't you think it's sad what's happened to the water? Our water's going bad. Oceans, rivers, lakes, and streams have all been touched by man.
Underwater.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is David Wallace Wells, a National Fellow at the New America Foundation and a columnist and deputy editor at New York Magazine. He was previously the deputy editor of the Paris Review, and his latest book just out is The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Wallace Wells.
Thanks for having me.
And David, this is Sunday, and I'm on tape. We're on tape, I should say. I'm visiting my three-year-old granddaughter on the East Coast, and your book suggests that by the time she's about 30 years old, the Earth is going to be a pretty horrible place to live, and that really stabs at my heart. And one of the people, or the many people who endorsed your book, Tim Snyder, the historian at Yale, said, if we don't want our grandchildren to curse us, we'd better read this book. So you've put me on notice.
Yeah, I think things are likely to get considerably worse in the quite immediate future. I think that for a long time, we were generally speaking mistaken in believing that climate change was arriving quite slowly and we could have several generations to figure our way around it or out of it. In fact, half of all of the emissions that we've put into the atmosphere from the burning of fossil fuels have come in just the last 30 years, which means we've brought ourselves basically from a stable climate to one where we're on the brink of real catastrophic suffering in just that amount of time, just 30 years, and the next 30 are going to be just as consequential. We will really be shaping the future of human life on this planet over these next couple of decades, and we will be seeing the impact of exactly how we're doing on that metric in something like real time. But I think it's important to remember that, you know, however horrible climate change could get, and it will probably get quite bad and is, you know, can conceivably get really dramatically bad, the scale of those impacts, the scale of that possible suffering is really a reflection of the power that we retain over the climate. If we get to, say, 3 or 4 degrees of warming this century, that will be because of actions we take from here on out, and our hands are always going to be on those levers. Human inputs are always going to be the most important driver of future climate change. And so, as overwhelming, as horrifying as it can be to contemplate some of these outcomes, I think they're also a reminder that everything is within our power, and if we choose to avoid them and choose to commit to avoiding them, we can.
But given what you just said about how much damage has been done in the last 30 years, in this last 30 years, it was about 30 years ago that Bill McKibben wrote The End of Nature. And then subsequently, of course, Al Gore made those two films warning us about climate change. So what's happening there? Why is it that this can't penetrate our consciousness? How much more evidence do we need?
I'm not sure it's a matter of evidence, but I think that the signs are actually relatively encouraging about public opinion, public polling. The support for action is much more widespread than it was just a few years ago, and I think that that's all room for encouragement. In the U.S., 73% of Americans believe in climate change, believe it's happening. 70% of them are concerned about it. Those numbers are up about 15% since 2015. They're up about 8% since March. That's really fast movement by any political science measure. The problem is it's not fast enough when you look at the timeline of action that we need to avoid really terrible warming. And as you point out, our recent record, our recent history suggests that, you know, the more we know, it has almost no effect on how we act. All of these, this damage that we've done has been done, you know, since Bill McKibben published his book, since Al Gore published his book, since the UN established the IPCC. And over that time, we've had great progress on technology. Our renewable energy has gotten a lot cheaper. And yet, the proportion of clean energy to dirty energy hasn't grown at all. So we've responded to innovations, inventions, and market progress, not by retiring dirty energy sources and reducing our carbon footprint globally, but by simply adding energy capacity to our, you know, to the problem. You know, as for how that makes you feel going forward, you know, it's not the most hope-giving, optimistic situation that we find ourselves in. We've done all of this damage to ourselves very quickly, and there's very little reason to think that we will change course. But as I say, it's possible. It's not baked in. And I think that's important to remember. If, you know, some deniers will say, well, this is, you know, these are just natural cycles. We're not seeing warming that's the result of human action. We're seeing the result of warming that's coming out of the climate directly. And first of all, that's sort of bunk science. But second of all, if that were the case, it should terrify us so much more. It should be a kind of a comfort that we retain control over the system, even if we've shown so little willingness to really change. As for why we've shown so little willingness to change, I think it's a quite complicated question. And I think there are a lot of factors, you know, ranging from the forces of political inaction, fossil fuel money, and that kind of thing, all the way down to the individual level, where even people who are quite concerned about the issue are not all that focused on it, don't organize their lives around it, don't even organize their politics around it. And I think ultimately that's the sort of global problem that we're dealing with, because, you know, there isn't anywhere else in the world like the U.S. that has climate denial in it. There's no other country in the world that has a party as resistant to action on climate as the U.S. has. Many countries in the world are much more green in their political rhetoric than we are. And yet, basically no country of the world is behaving responsibly when it comes to carbon. No major industrial nation in the world is on track to meet its commitments under Paris. And given how universal that bad behavior is, I think, you know, I think we have to look at ourselves and our own biases and our own psychological reflexes, our own emotional reflexes, to really answer the question of why we haven't acted, all of which I think push us away from looking squarely at the science and taking it seriously, and instead encourage us to live through compartmentalization and denial about the issue, because we don't want to stare in the face of the threat. It's too scary.
And again, I'm speaking with David Wallace Wells, who's a National Fellow at the New America Foundation and a columnist and deputy editor at New York Magazine. He was previously the deputy editor of the Paris Review, and his latest book just out is The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming. Well, clearly we have a president who's turned back the clock, and the window is closing on what time left we have to deal with global warming and the looming catastrophic results from global warming. And as we made clear, that essentially 30 years have been lost since people warned us about this clear and present danger, which is now accelerated. I don't know what's going on with President Trump, and it's broader than him. It's the Republican Party at large. We know that the Koch brothers have a lot of influence over them. I don't know whether he's a sadist or what exactly. I mean, his daughter apparently is supposedly concerned about it, and I think she introduced both Leonardo DiCaprio and Al Gore in the transition period, but clearly they did not sway Trump. But just the other day, I was pulled into a parking lot, and next to this huge black SUV with those big tires, and it had these enormous tailpipes that shot up out of the cab, you know, into the air, like massive chimney stacks. And the car was festooned with pro-Trump stickers and Confederate flags, etc. I'd like to understand. I know it's more extreme. I think those that are indifferent are just as criminal in a sense, but those who sort of actively denied or even proudly deny climate change, which I think you could tar Trump with that brush, what's going on with them? It sort of strikes me as the same kind of pathology that somebody with lung cancer continues to smoke cigarettes, or somebody with diabetes eating tubs of ice cream.
Well, I would think those last two analogies apply to really all of us. I mean, I certainly include myself in that as well. Everything I do, everything you do, has some kind of carbon footprint, and we're neither of us. I don't know much about your life, but I can just say, generally speaking, people like us are not doing nearly enough to change that. But there is, you know, there is a group of people who, as you say, are really kind of proudly hostile to the very idea that this is a problem. And I think, you know, I think that reflects American partisan politics, that we live in an incredibly tribalized era. And if one side is really agitated about one issue, there are going to be at least some people on the other side who are excited to just thumb their nose at those people and that issue, however it might be related to their own lives, however it might affect their own lives. It's like a kind of partisan score setting and exciting in that way to really thumb your nose at liberals who are concerned about climate change. But I think, again, I think that while that is a feature of American life, it's an unfortunate feature of American life, I don't think that it's as determinative as many on the American left tend to think that it is. So if we have 73% of Americans who believe that global warming is real and happening now, that means that only 27% of Americans don't believe it. 26% of Americans believe that aliens live among us, and we don't have a politics that is distorted or deformed by that belief in the same way that we have a politics that's distorted and deformed by climate denial. You know, I think there's also the additional sort of explanatory force of fossil fuel money and the way that those forces have kind of captured the Republican Party. But again, American politics is basically the only politics in the world where one of the major parties is as in denial as the Republican Party is here, and yet nowhere in the world are people behaving more responsibly towards carbon than we are. So again, I think that we have a kind of a tendency to look for easy villains, and it's certainly the case that the Republican Party, climate deniers, and the fossil fuel business have been truly villainous on this front. But I think it's also important to understand that they are not simple explanations for the state that we're in right now. In fact, most of the reason that we're in a kind of a state of climate crisis in 2019 is because of the industrialization of the developing world. So it's action that hasn't even happened inside the U.S. or in the EU. It's been the development of China and India, and to a lesser extent, sub-Saharan Africa. Now, I think the U.S. and the EU and the U.K. have a moral responsibility to play a leadership role on climate because of the historical role that we played in creating this problem. But over the last couple of decades, and certainly going forward into the next, the climate future of the planet will be determined by those other countries much more significantly than by ours. And so while we have an obligation to kind of show the way and demonstrate that you can live prosperous, just, fulfilling lives within much smaller carbon footprints, the real story is going to be determined by some of these other nations and the decisions and paths that they take going forward.
Well, it would be great if there was a whole new paradigm that could be just completely installed, if you will, with these developing countries. Their attitude, I'm sure, is, look, you guys have been fat and happy for the longest time, and we're just starting to get a little bit of the crumbs under the table, and now you're telling us we can't have what you've had for decades?
Yeah, well, I think that is a very pointed and helpful, incisive way of thinking about it and looking at it. Thankfully, I think there is a bit of a new paradigm being put into place because already in much of the world, not all of the world yet, but in much of the world, green energy is now cheaper than dirty energy. And I think in short order, it will be cheaper everywhere in the world. And that will mean that the remaining global poor can emerge out of global poverty into something like global middle classness without taking the same fossil fuel driven path that China has taken recently and the West took 100 years ago or so. Now, how quickly we can install new energy infrastructure in those countries and how quickly, therefore, those people can take that more responsible path, that's a little bit of an open question. Depends a lot about national politics, local politics. But in principle, I think in relatively short order, it will be the case that they can behave more responsibly without foregoing the economic growth that is obviously morally, you know, imperative that they embrace. Because, as you say, so many of us in the West have benefited so enormously from the wealth created by the burning of fossil fuels. It would be criminal to deprive some of that wealth from those who are now most in need. But I think going forward, we won't need to ask them to make that choice. That's my hope, anyway.
Well, when you mentioned a little while ago, David Wallace Wells, that the U.S. is the only country that has active denial, but other countries that have stayed with Paris, the Paris Accords, which, of course, Trump took the U.S. out of, are nevertheless not meeting their goals. I mean, for example, Russia's entire economy is based upon
burning fossil fuels, and I don't see them changing at all. Do you?
Well, no, I think Russia is one of the countries in the world where things are going to be most complicated. But I also think that it's not too hard to imagine a new geopolitics of climate, of carbon evolving over the next decade or so that will make the community of nations much more focused on how each country is behaving with regard to carbon than they have in the past, so that exactly what you're doing on climate change could become as important for your reputation on the world stage as, say, your human rights record is today. And that could mean a future in which a nation like Russia was sanctioned, possibly even quite aggressively, for bad behavior on carbon, or possibly even something, you know, punished in some way more aggressively, say, with military action. I think that's sort of hard to imagine now, but if you had said to someone in the 1910s or 1920s that just 30 or 40 years into the future there would be wars fought in the name of human rights, I think they would have been quite surprised as well. And I think the world will be transformed by the force of climate change in exactly that kind of a way, so that several decades from now, it will be impossible to think about geopolitics, to think about domestic politics, to think about economics, to think about our relationship to technology, without really first thinking about the state of the climate, because it is just that all-encompassing a system which will affect and, in most cases, damage everything about the way that we live. Now, you know, I also, on a more encouraging front, see MBS, the leader of Saudi Arabia, talking about how he needs his country's economy to go entirely off oil by 2050, probably mostly off oil by 2030. And MBS is a kind of horrific figure in many, many ways and not someone you want to applaud. But that contains some real wisdom about how the world is evolving. He thinks he understands, and I hope he's right, that a decade or so down the line, a country couldn't be as dependent on oil as Saudi Arabia is today and still expect a seat at the table of nations. And what that means for the future of the world generally remains to be seen. But I think that we are moving in that direction, probably quite rapidly, and we'll have to develop a kind of new politics around carbon to make sense of the new climate future that we find ourselves in, with considerably more resource scarcity, considerably larger refugee crisis, and many more challenges and threats than we can really process or imagine right now.
Let's take a brief station break, and we'll continue the conversation with David Wallace Wells about his new book just out, The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming.
Oh, but hell, I'm just a blind man on the plains. I drink my water when it rains and live by chance among the lightning strikes. Oh, once I held a glacier to a hollow.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And we're continuing the conversation with David Wallace Wells, who is a national fellow at the New America Foundation and a columnist and deputy editor at New York Magazine. And he was previously the deputy editor of the Paris Review. And his latest book just out is The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming. So just let's quickly go through the alternative energies. I mean, of course, the Green New Deal is getting a lot of attention. And as we mentioned earlier, Trump has turned back the clock. This has been, you know, 4 years, assuming he lasts 4 years. It's 4 years wasted, in effect. And of course, he's talked about bringing back coal, which is not necessarily happening. But coal is about as bad as it gets in terms of CO2. But natural gas has been ballyhooed as the great replacement for coal, because its footprint's about a half in terms of CO2. but there's an awful lot of leakage of methane associated particularly with fracking for natural gas, and nuclear, where it doesn't have a carbon footprint, is incredibly expensive, and nobody knows quite what to do with the radioactive waste part of it. And I don't see any clamor on Wall Street to start investing in nuclear. So would you agree with that sketch of the alternatives short of the wind and solar?
Yeah, I mean, I think in general we have to probably invest some amount of money in nuclear to get those prices down. But I also think that wind and solar are quite appealing alternatives that are quite scalable and quite cheap right now. So when I look at the problem, the sort of bigger picture problem of our global carbon footprint, I don't see energy as the most problematic sector. I actually see it as the least problematic sector. I think that we probably need to do the least to get ourselves all the way to zero emissions there. And I think that market forces are sort of already driving us in that direction, even if they're not driving us there fast enough. The other sectors are more complicated. There's transportation, there's industry, there's agriculture. Each of these has is much more complicated to solve than the energy problem. And in some cases, there are interventions that can be undertaken relatively soon with existing technology. In other cases, we're ways off from that. We really don't have anything like a carbon-free plane that will be available anytime soon. And we know that the world is not about to give up air travel. So where does that leave us? We can replace some of that travel with high-speed rail, but certainly not all of it. You can't go from New York to Japan on high-speed rail. And we are quite far from having planes that can take us those distances without imposing a massive carbon impact. You know, the average round-trip flight in the U.S. from New York to Los Angeles is the equivalent of 8 months of driving, and every round-trip flight from New York to London is every seat on every flight, New York to London, melts about 3 square meters of Arctic ice. It's every single seat on every single one of those planes. Flying is really, you know, jet travel is only 2%, I think, of the global carbon problem, but it's growing, and we don't have an easy solution to it. Similar problems with a lot of heavy industry. Agriculture seems to me to be an area where there's some more available solutions, but even so, it's a quite thorny, complicated problem, much more thorny and more complicated than energy. And I think we really need to aggressively focus our political energy and also our R&D investments in those areas so that we can make transitions that we need to make rather than just sort of waiting for the transitions to happen by themselves.
Well, I think transportation, in terms of its contribution to CO2, in terms of the countries that are the biggest emitters, I think the US is still number one, I think China's two, is India three, I'm not sure, but I understand transportation itself, that includes aircraft and ships at sea, is about number five, isn't it?
I don't, you may be right, I don't know those numbers off the top of my head, but that seems totally plausible to me.
Right. And it's a little ironic that people who care about global warming and meet at Davos also fly there in private jets, right?
Yeah. I think in general that we have an inclination, we have a kind of reflex. We hope to see a single silver bullet solution. We hope to see, this kind of invention is going to save us, or this kind of policy action is going to save us. It's far too massive and far too complicated a problem to solve with just one approach, one solution. And so we're going to have to get down to quite tiny slices of the pie and focus on shrinking those slices as well, because we just won't be able to make the progress necessary in any one sector. It's going to require us to focus on all sectors, no matter how small.
So since I'm visiting my granddaughter back east, and we're on tape today, David Wallace Wells, she just turned 3. So give us a picture of what the world will look like when she's about 30 years old, which is, I take it, when you think we reach the point of no return.
Well, I think it's probably around the time when we'll be at about 2 degrees or a little north of 2 degrees of warming by mid-century. And that is if we don't take dramatic action and we kind of continue on the course we're on. It's also possible that we take some amount of action, which will mean that we'll still end up at 2 degrees or north of 2 degrees, but not as soon as 2050. So let's just talk about that temperature rise. At say 2.5 degrees, we will have begun the irreversible melt of some of the world's biggest ice sheets, which over time, it'll take centuries, but over time could raise sea levels hundreds of feet, several hundred feet. We would have, according to the UN, at least 200 million climate refugees, possibly as many as a billion climate refugees. That's as many people as live in North and South America combined. We would have many cities in South Asia and the Middle East that would be literally unlivable during summer, that you couldn't go outside. You certainly couldn't work outside without risking heat stroke and possibly death. Some of these cities now house 10, 12, 15 million people, and they would be, practically speaking, uninhabitable for parts of the year. Now, we have some time to adjust to these changes. They're not going to happen overnight. And so it's not as though there's like one door is open and then suddenly it's shut and we're in a whole different world. That's not how climate works. It's not binary. It unfolds slowly over time, and we will adjust accordingly. But if we get to a place in 2050 where whole parts of the Middle East and South Asia are, practically speaking, uninhabitable, that will really have a dramatic impact on our global politics and our economies. And I don't think we can sort of walk blithely into that situation, assuming that it will work itself out. Even if it is the case that some features of it will work out, we will continue to have something like civilization. We will continue to have something like recognizable forms of modern life. But they will be so transformed by these forces that, looking at them from the vantage of today, we might not even recognize them. And that's really the sort of central subject of my book, not just what's going to happen to us, but not just what climate change is going to do, what it promises, what's coming down down the pike, what is scheduled to happen, but what it will mean for the way that we all live together on this planet, how we will organize our lives, where we will look for meaning, how we will understand ourselves in relation to nature, how we will understand ourselves in history. And I think there are some real profound changes on those fronts to come. I think it's a whole area of inquiry. I think of it as kind of the humanities of climate change that really hasn't been explored yet. And I think some of those impacts will be more profound even than the direct impacts of climate change.
So when would the ocean be lapping at the doorsteps of Mar-a-Lago down in Florida? Yeah.
Well, I think those risks are actually quite around the corner. I mean, most of South Florida is really low-lying and really vulnerable to sea level rise. I think that those lands are unlikely to be livable at some point in the second half of the century. I think it's going to require that little sea level rise. Now, there are some accommodations we can make. There are some protections we can build. We can build seawalls. We can move people off the coast, because, again, it's not something that one day you're going to wake up and a whole city that was above water is suddenly underwater. But all of that infrastructure building is really expensive. And frankly, since it's happening everywhere in the world, it will require prioritization and sort of rationing of resources. And that raises another big question, which is climate change is universal. It will affect all of us. It will affect all of our lives, but it also affects us unequally. Its impacts are distributed unequally, and unfortunately, resources will be distributed unequally too, which means that those most in need, the global poor, the global south, are likely to be even worse off, relatively speaking, 50 years from now than they are today, because those of us living in the relatively affluent corners of the world will be able to do some things, probably a lot of things, to protect ourselves. But those people living in the equatorial band of the world, in the low-lying regions in, say, India and Bangladesh, will be able to do much less. And exactly how that opens up onto the geopolitical stage, I don't know for sure, but I would not at all be surprised if there were major calls for climate reparations and, that kind of negotiation over who owes what to whom, who will pay for what kinds of protections, and who's responsible for the immense, probably unprecedented suffering that we're likely to see over the course of the century as climate change really begins to unfold.
And of course, what's so scary about the process of climate change is that it's self-reinforcing. It accelerates. In other words, just the more the Arctic and Antarctic ice melts, the less light is reflected back out into the atmosphere from the white snow to the dark ocean, then increases. And then the tundra, of course, melts and releases more methane, which is the most pernicious of global warming gases. So that is, unfortunately, how it is in terms of science. It accelerates. So just in the last minute, let's talk briefly about the example you give in your book about how Syria, that country that's literally died before our eyes, is in many ways an example of what happens with global warming, because global warming did play a part in the disintegration of that country.
Yeah, the civil war that took place a few years ago in Syria was not, you know, everybody's careful to say it was not caused in a simplistic way by climate change, but climate change was a factor because it was a drought that produced a kind of famine that led to civil unrest and war. And, you know, you can look next door at Lebanon, they went through similar climate conditions and they didn't have a civil war. But my perspective on this is that if climate change makes some event more likely, it's sort of dismissive to say that it was not a cause. So I think it's quite fair to say that that civil war was caused by climate change to some degree. It produced a refugee crisis. 12 million people left the country. 1 million went to Europe, and that 1 million in Europe really destabilized all of European politics. I think it played a role in Brexit. And you could even say it's played a role in the election of Donald Trump because it's had such a cascading impact through our global politics. The UN says that we're likely to see a climate crisis that's at least 100, perhaps 200, perhaps 1,000 times as big as that over the next few decades. And just what that will mean for the way that we all live together, I think we don't know yet, but it's clear that the impacts will be profound, and it's important for us to look seriously at the science and think seriously about what it will mean for the way that we live together.
Well, David Wallace-Wells, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with David Wallace-Wells, who's a National Fellow at the New America Foundation and a columnist and deputy editor at New York Magazine. He was previously the deputy editor of the Paris Review, and his latest book just out is The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.